So imagine you lock the heavy steel doors of your house, you turn on the perimeter alarm, and you go to sleep feeling, you know, perfectly secure.
Right. You've done everything you're supposed to do.
Exactly. You've invested heavily in that front door. It's got biometric scanners, a deadbolt, the works.
Yeah.
But what you don't realize is that a thief is actually already standing inside your living room.
Which is terrifying.
Right. And your most valuable possessions, I mean, your life savings, your private journals, identity documents, they're just sitting right there on the coffee table in this flimsy cardboard box.
Yeah, totally unprotected.
And in the world of enterprise cybersecurity, you know, particularly in healthcare, this isn't some hypothetical thought experiment. It is the exact architectural reality that thousands of organizations are living with right now.
It really is a terrifying reality when you actually sit down and map it out.
Yeah.
Because we suffer from this collective psychological comfort, I guess you'd call it, where we equate a hard perimeter with total security.
We just trust the lock on the front door.
Exactly. But the moment an attacker bypasses that hard outer shell, they discover a completely soft, unprotected center.
Right.
And when the assets sitting in that unprotected center are sensitive medical records, genomic data, or, you know, proprietary pharmaceutical research.
Game over.
Yeah. That architectural blind spot goes from being a mere IT problem to a catastrophic organizational failure.
Well, welcome to the deep dive, everyone. Today, we are tearing into a massive stack of source materials. We're looking at technical executive summaries, really detailed architectural white papers, and rigorous FDA compliance documentation.
This heavy stack today.
It really is. And all of this originates from a company called Transformative IP. The core of this material details a massive paradigm shift in how we actually protect data.
Right. We're getting into the really cutting edge stuff.
We are. Specifically, we're looking at their proprietary security solutions. So technologies with names like QInfoSecure, QSecureKey, and PQC+B.
And crucially, how all of those actively integrate with Microsoft Intune.
Yes, that integration is key. And our mission for this analysis is to explore why the conventional wisdom around mobile device management, or MDM, is just systematically failing high-stakes environments.
Because it is failing. We see it in the headlines every week.
Oh, absolutely. So we're going to look at how a true defense-in-depth architecture is stepping in to achieve incredibly strict FDA compliance.
Yeah, the FDA is not messing around anymore.
No, they are not. And more importantly, we'll see how this tech is being deployed to protect medical data against threats that technically haven't even fully matured yet.
Right, like quantum computing.
Exactly. And let's be clear right up front about who needs to hear this.
Yeah, this is important.
If you are a CEO, a chief technology officer, a CISO, or frankly, just someone fascinated by the collision of healthcare and next generation cybersecurity, this deep dive is going to fundamentally reshape how you evaluate your digital defenses.
Because we are dealing with highly regulated life or death environments here.
We really are. But before we can appreciate the elegance of the solution that Transformative IP has built, we have to spend some time exposing the critical flaw in how most of the industry operates today.
We have to talk about the front door problem.
Yes, the front door problem. Okay, let's unpack this. If you are managing an enterprise IT environment today, you know Microsoft Intune.
You probably live in it, honestly.
Right. It is essentially the gold standard for mobile device management. It controls network connections, pushes out mandatory software patches, and forces baseline compliance.
It's the tool checking to make sure a hospital iPad hasn't been jailbroken, right?
Exactly. Making sure it has a complex passcode before it's allowed to connect to the hospital's Wi-Fi.
Intune is absolutely vital. I mean, it functions as the ultimate gatekeeper for the hardware.
The bouncer at the club.
Yeah, the bouncer.
Yeah.
When a device requests access, Intune performs this detailed attestation check. It looks at the OS version, the encryption status of the hard drive, the presence of any malicious apps.
It's asking one fundamental question, right?
Exactly. It's asking, is this specific piece of hardware mathematically trustworthy enough to be allowed onto our corporate network?
But the Transformative IP white papers highlight this massive logical fallacy in how organizations actually use that bouncer.
Right. The front door versus the file cabinets analogy.
Yeah, I love this analogy. I want to lean into it. They say, if Intune is acting as this heavy, impeccable lock on the front door of the building, controlling exactly who gets into the lobby.
Why are the file cabinets inside the building left completely unlocked?
Exactly. Why, once a device passes that initial Intune check, are the actual patient records, the lab results, left entirely exposed to anyone who managed to get inside?
And that right there is the fatal assumption of device-centric security.
Because it assumes the device is safe, so everything on it is safe.
Right. It assumes that because the device passed the front door check, everything happening inside that device from that moment forward is inherently trustworthy.
Which is crazy when you think about it.
It is. Intune, by its very design, is built to secure the container, not the payload. It secures the smartphone or the diagnostic tablet.
But once it grants access, its primary job is effectively finished.
Exactly. It essentially says, okay, the container is safe, my work here is done. It completely ignores the fact that the payload inside the container still needs to be defended.
And we know, empirically, that attackers bypass that front door all the time.
Oh, constantly.
I mean, let's look at the absolute nightmare scenario that just happened with Stryker.
Oh, wow. Yeah, the Iranian hacker incident. That is the perfect example here.
It really is. So for anyone listening who missed it, Stryker is a massive American medical technologies corporation. And they got hit by sophisticated Iranian state-sponsored hackers.
And the financial fallout was catastrophic.
We're talking an estimated $25 million consequence. $25 million.
And the crazy part is, they had standard MDM in place.
Exactly. That's the whole point. The attackers didn't invent some magical new map to break the cryptographic lock on the MDM. They just bypassed it.
They stole the keys.
Right. They used compromised credentials or exploited a vulnerability that let them hijack a quote-unquote compliant device.
And suddenly the attacker is standing inside the building.
The Intune perimeter didn't stop them because they were walking through the door wearing an employee's stolen jacket, basically.
Precisely. And because the organization relied entirely on that perimeter defense, the data itself had no armor.
The file cabinets were wide open.
Wide open. The attacker didn't have to pick any more locks. They just walked up to the cabinets, opened the drawers, and exfiltrated whatever they wanted.
Which is why standard MDM treating the device as the fortress is a fundamentally flawed architecture.
Especially when the device is a highly portable, easily lost, constantly connected smartphone.
So to put this directly to you listening, if you are a CEO or a CTO sitting in a boardroom right now, feeling confident because your entire fleet is enrolled in a top-tier MDM like Intune.
You need to recognize the blind spot.
You absolutely do. You have built a titanium front door, but your crown jewels are sitting in unlocked cardboard boxes in the hallway.
If a nation-state attacker pivots past the device attestation, like we saw with Stryker, your medical records are gone. There is no secondary defense.
Which is exactly why the regulatory bodies, particularly in healthcare, are no longer accepting quote-unquote good enough perimeter security.
No, they can't afford to. A single breached record can result in devastating privacy violations, massive HIPAA fines, and just a total loss of patient trust.
The architecture has to evolve.
Right.
And that evolution requires a total shift in focus.
We have to move from protecting the perimeter to protecting the payload.
Yes. And this is exactly what Transformative IP is doing with their three-layered architecture. Now, before we get into the weeds, I want to clarify something for the CTOs listening.
Right. The rip and replace fear.
Exactly. Their architecture does not replace Microsoft Intune.
That's a crucial detail. You aren't ripping out your existing infrastructure.
No. You're not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. Transformative IP suite is designed to integrate seamlessly with and build upon the foundation Intune provides.
It's about hardening Intune, making it nation-state resistant.
Right. So let's break down this three-layered architecture based on the source documents. Layer one is still the gatekeeper.
Microsoft Intune.
Yep. The documents are very clear that Intune maintains its ongoing vital role. It is still the bouncer at the door checking every device.
Checking if the phone is encrypted, if the OS is up to date, if the user rooted the device.
Right, doing all those basic hygiene checks. If it fails, Intune blocks it at the network edge.
It provides the necessary baseline of device health. You still need that, but it's only layer one.
So we pass the bouncer, we get inside the building, and now we hit layer two. The vault.
This is where it gets really innovative.
It does. The vault is powered by a suite within Transformative IP's platform called PQC plus OI, specifically utilizing components they call Smart Compliance and Smart MCP.
Which sounds like a lot of jargon, I know.
It is a lot of jargon. The documentation gets incredibly dense here, but it essentially describes the vault doing something almost magical with the absolute nightmare that is healthcare compliance.
It acts as an automated policy engine.
Exactly. It automatically determines the geographic location of the medical data owner, the role of the user requesting it, and applies the correct state-level regulations before the data is ever accessed.
What's fascinating here is the sheer complexity of what that automated action actually places in the real world.
Because healthcare compliance in the U.S. is not a monolith at all.
No, not even close. You have the federal baseline of HIPAA, sure, but then you have an absolute patchwork of state-level privacy regulations that contradict and overlap with each other.
Oh, it's a massive headache. What's perfectly legal to share with a specialist in Texas might require explicit, verifiable written consent to share in California.
And if the patient travels from California to New York, the rules might shift again based on the origin of the data.
Right. And traditionally, managing that was a nightmare of manual legal review.
Or it relied on really clunky, hard-coded software rules that broke every time a state legislature passed a new privacy bill.
But the Vault utilizes a hybrid design to solve this. The documents explain it combines role-based access control, or RBAC.
Which asks the basic question, who are you and what is your job title?
Exactly. It combines RBAC with something much more dynamic called attribute-based access control, or ABC.
ABC is the game changer here.
Right. So attribute-based access control, instead of just looking at my title as, say, doctor, it's looking at the surrounding context.
Precisely. ABC looks at the environmental variables.
Mm-hmm.
It asks, where is this data originating? Where is the patient legally domiciled?
What's the current consent status flagged in their chart?
Exactly. What time of day is the request happening and from what IP address? The Vault takes all of these variables, cross-references them against a continuously updated legal framework, and dynamically generates access control lists.
Or ACLs.
Right, ACLs.
So these ACLs are essentially highly specific digital permission slips.
They are absolute mathematically coded rules. And the Vault doesn't just create a static rule. It actually manages the start and stop dates for these rules based on patient consent.
So if a patient revokes consent for a research study on a Tuesday,
the Vault dynamically updates the ACL to sever access on Tuesday.
Wow.
It translates incredibly complex human legal requirements into automated, unbending mathematical logic before the data even begins to move through the network.
Okay, so layer two, the Vault, is the brain. It figures out the legal parameters and writes the permission slips.
Right.
But a permission slip is just a piece of paper unless someone is actually standing there to enforce it. Which brings us to layer three, the enforcer.
This is where the real security magic happens.
This is where the platform pairs PQC Plus with their Q InfoSecure and Q SecureKey technologies. The texts explicitly state that even if device passes Intune's layer one checks,
and even if the user has a valid role,
right, the actual data inside the Vault remains completely locked until layer three intervenes.
This is the critical paradigm shift we talked about.
Yeah.
This is the move from device-level security to object-level security.
Yes. Here's where it gets really interesting. The documents describe how every single individual record, let's say it's a specific FHIR resource, which is just a standard format for electronic healthcare records.
Right.
Every single one of those records is individually encrypted with its own distinct Q SecureKey.
So we aren't just encrypting the hard drive of the iPad anymore.
Exactly. We are putting a separate, unique cryptographic padlock on every single file inside the cabinet.
And that padlock requires a very specific, dynamically generated token to open.
But the brilliance of the enforcer layer is the mechanism it uses to determine who actually gets that token.
Right. It's not just asking a central server for permission.
No, it uses the embedded access control list.
Mm-hmm.
The documentation emphasizes this heavily. The access rules, those permission slips the Vault generated using all that complex ABAC logic, they aren't stored on some remote server.
They don't have to be queried over the network every time a doctor wants to look at an MRI.
Exactly. The rules are cryptographically embedded directly into the data payload itself.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this solves what security architects call the traveling data problem.
Oh, right. Because historically, if you took a sensitive file out of a secure database and downloaded it to a mobile device, the file left its security behind.
Exactly. The database was secure, but the exported file was naked.
Naked and vulnerable.
Yep. But with an embedded ACL, the data carries its security posture with it everywhere it goes. It is cryptographically wrapped.
So whether that file is sitting on a hospital-issued smartphone or traveling across a public cellular network or resting in a third-party cloud bucket,
the mathematical rules dictating who can open it are fused to the data itself.
It's like having a titanium briefcase that literally knows who is holding it and simply refuses to physically open if it doesn't recognize the fingerprints.
That's a great way to put it.
And the enforcer layer goes even further than just a binary open or shut. based on the patient's consent defined in those embedded ACLs, the system will automatically de-identify or mask the data to ensure compliance.
Right, redaction on the fly.
Exactly. So if a clinical researcher is legally allowed to see the longitudinal medical data for a study, but HIPED dictates they cannot see the patient's personally identifiable information,
the enforcer dynamically redacts the name, the address, the social security number before the file is even decrypted for that specific user.
It guarantees compliance at the cryptographic level. You aren't relying on a hospital's HR policy or an employee's promise not to peek.
No, the system simply makes it mathematically impossible for the unauthorized data to render on the screen.
I really want to hammer home the sheer power of this capability by looking at the direct comparison the white papers draw between running Intune alone versus running Intune plus QSecurity.
Okay, yeah, let's look at a practical scenario.
Let's take the classic nightmare scenario, a lost or stolen device. A doctor leaves a hospital-issued tablet in the back of a taxi, or someone snatches it at a coffee shop.
Happens all the time.
All the time. With Intune alone, your standard protocol is to log into the admin console and initiate a remote wipe command to erase the device.
But a remote wipe is entirely dependent on connectivity.
Right.
It relies on the stolen device being connected to a cellular or Wi-Fi network to receive that wipe command from the Intune server.
And if a sophisticated thief steals that tablet, the very first thing they do is rip out the SIM card.
Or put the device in a Faraday bag to block all signals.
Exactly. And if they do that, or if they immediately hardwire the device to a computer and image the storage drive, your remote wipe command is just yelling into the void.
It's entirely useless. The data is compromised.
But with the addition of the transformative IP stack, if that device is lost and the thief manages to copy the raw data off the drive, it simply doesn't matter.
No, it doesn't.
The texts outline that the data stays encrypted and unreadable without the specific cryptographic token, that they've just copied a brick of mathematically scrambled noise.
They can't ask Intune for the token because they don't have the user's biometric login.
And even if they somehow spoofed the user, they don't have the enforcer to validate their identity against the embedded ACL. The file keeps itself locked forever.
It completely neutralizes the threat of physical device theft as a vector for data breaches. You still want to recover the hardware, obviously, but the panic over the data exposure is eliminated.
Which is an incredible peace of mind for a CTO.
Yeah.
But, you know, locking the data at rest on the hard drive is only one side of the coin.
Because data have to move.
Right. Medical devices, smartphones, diagnostic machines, they aren't static. They have to communicate. They transmit highly sensitive data back and forth to servers and cloud environments constantly.
So we've locked the file cabinet. But what happens when we have to carry the file across the street?
Exactly. How do we protect data in motion, especially against the looming, almost existential threat of next-generation computing?
We have to talk about the tunnel the data travels through.
And the quantum threat that is currently aiming directly at it.
Yes.
Let's start with the tunnel itself. When an app on your phone talks to a hospital server, it uses a protocol called TLS, or Transport Layer Security.
It's what puts the little padlock icon in your web browser.
Right. And the source materials point out that an alarming number of enterprise organizations today are still relying on standard TLS 1.2 for their internal network transmissions.
Which, to be fair, was a perfectly fine standard for a very long time.
But cryptography is a relentless arms race.
It is. Mm-hmm. And TLS 1.2 is aged out. It has known architectural weaknesses. It supports older, legacy cryptographic algorithms that sophisticated attackers, particularly state-sponsored actors like the ones who we had Stryker, have figured out how to exploit or bypass.
So Transformative IP's architecture mandates a strict upgrade to TLS 1.3 across the board.
It's non-negotiable in their SAC.
And the text note that the FDA now actively expects TLS 1.3 for any new medical device submissions. Now, there are practical operational benefits here too, right?
Definitely. TLS 1.3 requires fewer back and forth cryptographic handshakes to establish a secure connection between the device and the server.
Which means faster connection times.
Exactly. Mm. And if you are talking about a battery-powered medical device, like a wearable heart monitor, saving that transmission time actually saves critical battery life.
Which is a huge deal.
It is. But the main security upgrade, the real reason the FDA cares, is a cryptographic mechanism called perfect forward secrecy.
Yes. Okay, can we dive into exactly how that works? Because reading about it, it sounds a bit like a Hollywood spy trope, but the math behind it is brilliant.
It does sound theatrical, yeah. But perfect forward secrecy is arguably one of the most elegant concepts in modern cryptography.
How so?
Well, to understand why it's necessary, you have to look at how older systems worked. In a legacy TLS environment, the server and the medical device might use a single long-term master key.
Usually an RSA key, right?
Right, an RSA key. Mm-hmm. And they'd use that single master key to encrypt all of their session data over a span of months or even years.
It's like using the exact same master password for everything you do online.
Precisely. Now imagine an attacker is tapping the network line. They can't read the data because it's encrypted, but they just record everything.
They just passively harvest it.
Right. They store months and months of this scrambled, encrypted traffic on a hard drive somewhere. Then one day, they execute a successful breach on the hospital's main server and manage to steal that single long-term master key.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Because that one key was used to secure all the past traffic, the attacker can retroactively go back, apply the stolen key to their archive recordings, and unlock every single conversation.
Every single medical record transmission you've had for the past year?
Yes.
They get the master skeleton key, and all the past locked doors just swing wide open at once. It's a retroactive catastrophe.
Exactly. But perfect forward secrecy prevents that scenario entirely by changing the mechanics of the key exchange.
How does it do that?
Under TLS 1.3, with perfect forward secrecy, every single time the device and the server connect, for every single individual session, they use an algorithm to mathematically generate a unique, temporary, ephemeral encryption key.
An ephemeral key?
Right, usually using an elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman exchange. They use this ephemeral key for that one specific conversation.
And then what?
The very moment the session ends, the device and the server permanently discard and destroy the key. It ceases to exist in memory.
Wow. So even if a hacker breaks into the server next year and manages to steal the long-term identity keys, it doesn't help them at all.
Not at all. They cannot mathematically decrypt the session data they recorded yesterday because the specific ephemeral key used for yesterday's session literally does not exist anywhere in the universe anymore.
That is just phenomenal.
It really is. Past sessions remain entirely safe, moving forward perfectly. It contains the blast radius of a future key compromised strictly to the present moment.
But even with TLS 1.3 and perfect forward secrecy, the white papers introduce a threat that standard modern encryption simply wasn't built to withstand.
Right, the post-quantum threat.
Yes. The acronym PQC+ stands for post-quantum cryptography. The core assertion in these documents is pretty stark. They're saying standard encryption, the underlying math-like RSA and elliptic curve that protects all of global banking, military communications, healthcare right now,
it will all inevitably be breakable by quantum computers.
And PQC+ is built with entirely new algorithms designed to resist that specific future reality. But here's where I want to push back a bit.
Sure.
I want to play devil's advocate for the CISO or the CTO who is looking at their limited IT budget.
Okay, that.
Quantum computers capable of actually breaking modern 256-bit encryption do not fully exist yet. They are largely theoretical, or they exist in very early, unstable experimental stages in deep freeze labs somewhere.
That's...
So how does a CISO justify to their CEO or their board that they need to invest heavily right now in defenses against a threat that technically hasn't peaked yet? How do you justify that ROI?
Well, this raises an incredibly important question about the lifespan of data and the reality of modern cyber warfare.
Okay.
You are correct that a cryptographically relevant quantum computer one, stable enough to run Shor's algorithm and shatter RSA encryption, might be 5, 10, or even 15 years away.
Right.
But we have to look at the strategy that well-funded nation-state attackers and advanced syndicates are deploying today. It's an approach known in the intelligence community as harvest now, decrypt later.
Harvest now, decrypt later, meaning they are stealing the locked briefcases today, even though they know they don't have the tools to break the locks yet.
Exactly. They are sitting on the major internet backbone pipes or compromising internal networks, yeah, and siphoning off vast terabytes of fully encrypted TLS 1.2 traffic.
Oh.
They know perfectly well they can't break the math today with classical supercomputers. But global storage is incredibly cheap.
So they just hoard it.
They just dump all that encrypted medical data, longitudinal genomic data, proprietary pharmaceutical research. They dump it into massive data centers.
And they wait.
They are patiently stockpiling it, waiting for the day a viable quantum computer comes online. And the moment it does, they will feed all that harvested data into it, shatter the legacy encryption in minutes, and read everything.
That is chilling. It completely recontextualizes the threat landscape.
It does. And you have to consider this specifically in the context of healthcare. Data lifespans in healthcare are incredibly long.
Right, because if a hacker steals a credit card number, you cancel the card and the data is useless in 10 minutes.
Exactly. But a patient's medical history is relevant for their entire life. A person's genomic sequence never changes. It is permanent.
So if that data is harvested today, it will still be highly sensitive, highly damaging, and highly valuable on the black market if it is decrypted 10 or 20 years from now.
Precisely. Which is why PQC Plus utilizes entirely different mathematical foundations, like lattice-based cryptography.
Which quantum computers can't solve?
Theoretically, they are not equipped to solve it efficiently, no. If you encrypt the data with PQC Plus today, even when those quantum computers finally arrive, the math holding the lock shut will hold.
So it's not about defending against a future attack. It's about defending against a future decryption of a present-day attack.
Exactly.
That completely shifts the ROI conversation for a CEO. You aren't buying future security. You are buying permanent present security.
You're future-proofing your most critical assets right now.
Okay, so we have this brilliant theoretical security architecture mapped out. We have object-level encryption. We have ABAC-driven embedded ACLs that travel with the data. We have TLS 1.3 with perfect forward secrecy. And we have post-quantum cryptography.
It sounds impenetrable on paper.
It does. But it's one thing to build a great system in a sterile lab. It's another thing entirely to prove to a federal regulator that it actually works and won't endanger human lives in the real world.
Right.
Which brings us to navigating the FDA's incredibly high bar and what the texts call the fail-safe test.
And we should be clear here. The FDA does not hand out an authority to operate, or an ATO, lightly.
No, the regulatory scrutiny for connected medical devices has increased exponentially in the last few years.
It's intense.
The source documents outline that achieving this FDA pre-market certification requires satisfying four core pillars of a pre-market cybersecurity submission.
Let's walk through them.
Yeah, let's imagine we are the FDA auditors looking at the submission from Transformative IP and Intune. First up, the security architecture views.
The FDA doesn't just want a summary paragraph here.
No, they want exhaustive diagrams. They want to see the global system view, the data flow, the network architecture.
And specifically, the texts note, they want visual architectural proof that the embedded ACL is operating as a true second line of defense.
Entirely independent of the network perimeter. You have to prove, visually and logically, that the file cabinet has its own lock, totally separate from the front door.
Because the visual proof forces the manufacturer to explicitly map out every single trust boundary. You can't just hide behind vague claims of cloud security.
Right. You have to show exactly where the data is encrypted, where the keys are generated, and where the trust is verified. If you can't draw it, you don't understand it.
Exactly.
The second pillar is the cybersecurity traceability matrix. Honestly, reading the description of this in the white papers, it sounds like an auditor's absolute dream, but a software engineer's worst nightmare.
Oh, it is arguably the most rigorous and exhausting document in the entire FDA submission.
How does it work?
Well, the traceability matrix requires the manufacturer to explicitly link every conceivable threat to the exact piece of technology that mitigates it.
Okay.
And then you have to link that mitigation to a verifiable test result.
Yeah.
You cannot just submit a document that says our system is secure against data loss. The FDA will reject it outright. You have to be granular to the point of exhaustion.
The white paper gives a great concrete example of this workflow. Let's say the identified threat in the system is labeled SEC-001, unauthorized access to protected health information via a lost or stolen device.
Right. The auditor looks at SEC-001 and asks, what is your specific mitigation for this? And the matrix must link directly to the QSecurity embedded ACL.
It documents the exact mechanism.
Yes, that the ACL encrypts the data payload with a unique key, and access is only mathematically granted when both the user identity and the Intune device posture pass the checks simultaneously.
But the matrix doesn't stop at the engineering claim, does it?
No, it requires verification traceability. It has to link to the specific penetration test report, say, test report TR-102.
Which actively confirmed in a lab environment that the data remained encrypted when the authorization token was absent.
Exactly. It is a completely closed loop. Here is the threat. Here is the specific code that mitigates the threat, and here is the third-party lab result proving the code actually works.
It leaves absolutely no room for assumptions. It's unbelievably thorough.
It has to be.
So the third pillar of the submission is the Software Bill of Materials, or the SBOM. The texts describe this as a machine-readable, comprehensive inventory of all software components.
Right. Every single Intune SDK, every QSecurity library, the entire TLS 1.3 stack.
Every open source tool used to build the app. Why has the FDA become so obsessed with having what is essentially a digital ingredient list?
Because you cannot protect what you don't know you have. And modern software development has fundamentally changed. Nobody writes software from scratch anymore.
Right, they use building blocks.
Exactly. Modern applications are built on thousands of interconnected third-party libraries, APIs, and open source components. They are deeply nested dependencies.
Like the Log4j nightmare a few years ago.
Perfect example.
Huh.
If a zero-day vulnerability is discovered in a random, obscure cryptographic library maintained by three people halfway across the world, the FDA and the hospital and the manufacturer need to know within seconds if that specific vulnerable library is currently running inside a patient's pacemaker.
Or inside a hospital's diagnostic tablet.
Right. The SBOM allows for instantaneous automated auditing to confirm the supply chain is free from known vulnerabilities. Without it, you are flying completely blind during a crisis.
It's exactly like a recall notice in the auto industry. If a specific batch of airbags is defective, Ford doesn't recall every car they've ever made.
They look at the bill of materials and recall only the specific VINs that have that exact airbag.
Right. The SBOM does that, but mapped down to the specific lines of code in a medical device. And that ties directly into the fourth pillar, the vulnerability management plan.
Which the documents note is strictly required to meet Section 524B of the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act.
This is the manufacturer's legally binding plan for how they're going to actively monitor, patch, and update the system after it goes to market.
Because the work doesn't stop on launch day.
No, definitely not. But here is where the rubber really meets the road in the testing phase. The FDA doesn't just want to see the system work perfectly. They require something called the fail-safe test.
This is crucial.
Because, as the texts point out, security is relatively easy when everything goes right. The real test is what happens when things go wrong. So I want to ask you, what happens when the system is actively failing? What happens when it's under attack from the inside?
The regulatory philosophy here is a system must fail safely. In an emergency or during a compromise, the default state of the architecture must be secure and locked, not open and vulnerable.
If a bridge fails, it collapses. If a security architecture fails, it must turn into a vault.
Exactly.
Let's walk through the exact negative test case provided in the documentation because it plays out like a slow-motion car crash where the airbags deploy perfectly at the exact right millisecond.
Okay, let's set the scene.
Here is the setup. A hospital-issued medical device is fully compliant. It's properly enrolled in Microsoft Intune. The user has authenticated with a valid biometric login. They possess a valid QSecurity token. And they are actively accessing a highly sensitive FHIR medical record on the screen.
Everything is green. The system is working exactly as intended.
Then the trigger event happens. Let's say the user, perhaps maliciously or perhaps just foolishly trying to install an unauthorized app, executes a root or a jailbreak on the device while the session is active.
The exact moment that root exploit executes, the fundamental security posture of that hardware changes.
It goes from being a trusted environment to a hostile environment. Instantly.
Instantly.
Now, Intune, which, as we established in Layer 1, is constantly monitoring that baseline posture, detects the unauthorized privilege escalation.
Right. It immediately flags the device status in its database as non-compliant.
And it syncs this updated failed status to the back-end identity provider, which in this architecture is Azure AD or Microsoft Entra ID.
Yep.
Now, the user who, remember, is still physically holding the phone, still has an active Wi-Fi connection, and still technically has their valid user credentials entered, tries to swipe to open the next patient's medical record. What is the result?
The enforcer layer steps in immediately. When the user requests the next file, QSecurity interrogates the embedded ACL attached to that specific file.
Okay.
But, and this is the genius of the integration, it doesn't just look at the user's password. It queries the real-time posture of the device via the Entra ID integration.
It sees that non-compliant flag that Intune just raised milliseconds ago.
Exactly. And because the posture check fails the strict requirements of the embedded ACL, CUSA-Kyrki violently rejects the decryption request.
It refuses to release the key.
The data locks itself automatically. The application throws a compliance failure error on the screen, and absolutely no medical data is exposed.
Even though the TLS tunnel is still technically wide open and the user is still technically logged in?
Right.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the true functional definition of the embedded ACL being posture aware. It is a massive paradigm shift in access control.
It really is. Traditional security asks one question: who are you?
Posture aware security asks, who are you? Andy is the vehicle you are driving currently on fire.
I love that. Yes.
If the device is compromised, the system acts as an immediate kill switch for the data payload.
It severs the trust relationship immediately at the granular object level. It is a brilliant fail-safe that isolates the compromise to the hardware, protecting the data entirely.
It really is a masterpiece of integrated engineering. Mm-hmm. But passing that pre-market test, generating the S-bombs, getting the FDA's official stamp of approval, that just gets the medical device on the market. It gets you to day one.
Right.
But cybersecurity isn't a destination. It's an ongoing, relentless battle. What happens on day two? This brings us to the post-market reality and a concept detailed in the text called coordinated vulnerability disclosure.
Because day two is where the vast majority of systems actually fail in the real world.
A system that is perfectly secure on Monday can become critically vulnerable on Tuesday if a new zero-day exploit is discovered in the wild.
Exactly.
So the source texts outline that post-launch, this transformative IP platform automates continuous monitoring. It doesn't just sit there. It is constantly scanning the TLS 1.3 stack, pulling the Intune agents, and verifying the CUSA-Kyrki cryptographic libraries for emerging threats or anomalies.
And it features real-time alerting tied to automated systemic thresholds.
For example, a single root detection on a single device triggers that local data lock we just talked about. It isolates the single user.
It contains the blast radius to a single compromised endpoint. The rest of the hospital fleet continues operating normally.
Right. But the texts detail that if the system telemetry detects a 5% fleet noncompliance rate, meaning 5 out of every 100 devices across the entire hospital network suddenly start failing their emissions. In Nation, Sotune security checks simultaneously.
That triggers a massive system-wide review protocol.
Because a 5% failure rate doesn't imply that a bunch of users all decided to jailbreak their phones at the exact same minute.
No, it strongly implies a coordinated network-wide attack.
And Intune is positioned to react to that telemetry, isolating network segments, and pushing the required emergency patches within the strict timeframes mandated by that Section 524B we mentioned earlier.
Right. But there is one post-market regulatory requirement outlined in these documents that completely upends traditional corporate thinking.
Yes, coordinated vulnerability disclosure, or CVD.
The documents state clearly that implementing a robust CVD program is a mandatory FDA requirement for compliance moving into 2026.
It is a literal condition of certification. The regulations state that companies must provide a structured, public, legally safe harbor process for independent security researchers to find and report flaws in their systems.
Which is a huge shift.
It is. And let me push back on this, or at least voice the very real anxiety of every medical device CEO and corporate lawyer out there.
Yeah, I'm sure they are anxious.
How terrifying must it be to actively invite external hackers to poke at the very systems keeping your patients alive? Historically, the corporate playbook was entirely defensive.
Right. Deny and defend.
If an independent researcher found a flaw in your system and emailed you about it, you didn't thank them. You sent them a brutal cease and desist letter from a very expensive law firm threatening to ruin their life under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, the FDA is forcing these companies to set up a public submission portal, invite the scrutiny, and give these hackers a safe harbor agreement. That feels totally counterintuitive to traditional business logic.
Well, this raises an important question about the necessary evolution of cybersecurity culture, particularly in critical infrastructure. Mm-hmm. What you are describing, that old security through obscurity model, where you hide the flaws, bury your head in the sand, and threaten anyone who points them out, is completely dead.
It doesn't work anymore.
It's not just outdated, it is empirically dangerous to human life.
Because the malicious actors, the ransomware gangs, they are already poking at the system anyway, and they aren't asking for permission.
Exactly. Advanced persistent threats, nation-state actors, and ransomware syndicates do not care about your cease and desist letters. They don't care about your corporate lawyers. They are actively hunting for vulnerabilities 24/7.
Right.
So if an independent ethical researcher, a white hat hacker, finds a flaw in the QSecureKey implementation or discovers a bypass in the TLS stack, they are doing the manufacturer a massive, unquantifiable favor.
They are showing you the crack in the foundation before the enemy finds it and exploits it to hold a hospital hostage.
Precisely. The FDA recognizes that the sheer volume of code in modern medical devices is too vast for any single corporate QA team to secure perfectly. The only way to outpace malicious actors is to harness the collective intelligence of the global cybersecurity research community.
So the CVD policy provides a structured, predictable way to do that safely.
Yes.
The texts detail that it's not just about having an email address for tips. Companies have to commit to incredibly strict public response times. They have to formally acknowledge the researcher's vulnerability report within 3 days.
You have to fully triage and validate the vulnerability within 10 days.
And they have to develop, test, and deploy a patch, often utilizing Intune's update mechanisms, within 30 to 60 days, depending on the severity of the flaw.
It forces radical transparency and operational accountability.
I can't just sweep a critical bug under the rug anymore because fixing it might be expensive or embarrassing.
No. It creates a necessary symbiotic relationship. The ethical researchers get professional recognition, perhaps a bug bounty, and vital legal safety. And in return, the medical device manufacturer gets an army of highly skilled, free penetration testers, helping them secure the healthcare ecosystem.
It is a profound cultural shift from adversarial defensiveness to collaborative security.
It really is.
So what does this all mean? We have covered a massive amount of architectural, cryptographic, and regulatory ground today. Let's distill this deep dive down to its absolute core for the CEO or CTO listener who has to go back to their IT department tomorrow and evaluate their current posture.
Okay, the executive takeaway.
Right. We started with the unsettling realization that Microsoft Intune, while an incredibly powerful and necessary tool, is ultimately just a gatekeeper. It strictly secures the perimeter, but leaves the highly sensitive data payload entirely exposed if that perimeter is ever breached or bypassed.
Like we saw with the $25 million Stryker breach.
Exactly. But by integrating transformative IP solutions, specifically Q, InfoSecure, QSecureKey, and PQC Plus organizations, completely transform their defensive posture from the inside out. They create a zero vulnerability environment for that specific type of attack.
They achieve three defining next generation capabilities. First, object-level encryption. They stop relying on the physical hard drive and ensure that every single piece of medical data is individually locked, carrying its own cryptographically embedded access rules wherever it goes.
Second, posture-aware access control. The decision to decrypt a file isn't just about whether the user typed in the right password. It's dynamically tied to the real-time health and compliance of the device itself.
Right. If Intune flags a device as compromised or jailbroken, the data automatically locks itself down, serving as the ultimate automated failsafe.
And third, post-quantum readiness. They are utilizing advanced cryptographic algorithms designed today to withstand the inevitable arrival of quantum computing tomorrow.
This proactively defends the organization against the harvest now. Decrypt later strategies deployed by advanced, well-funded threat actors.
It takes a standard mobile device management tool, a tool designed to manage hardware, and elevates it into a fully documented, rigorously testable, end-to-end defense-in-depth security stack.
A stack that actually meets the FDA's exhausting pre-market and post-market requirements.
It closes the front door, yes, but more importantly, it locks every single file cabinet inside the building with a cryptographic key that cannot be stolen, spoofed, or retroactively broken. It transforms Intune into a quantum-secure, nation-state-resistant defense system.
It's the only logical path forward.
But I want to leave you, our listener, with a final lingering thought to mull over as you look at the future of healthcare technology. We've talked extensively today about how these embedded access control lists give hospitals and medical device manufacturers the immense power to program data.
To make the data know exactly who is allowed to view it, where they're allowed to view it, and when.
Right. It is a brilliant, necessary solution for complex regulatory compliance. But think about the logical conclusion of that specific cryptographic technology.
Oh, this is a fascinating angle.
If data can now be programmed with unbendable mathematical rules, what happens to the entire healthcare industry when patients themselves realize this technology exists and they demand to hold the master cryptographic keys to their own health records?
Wow.
What happens to the traditional hospital power structure when you, the patient, use a personalized embedded ACL to grant a specialist in another state access to your MRI for exactly 1 hour and then mathematically revoke it, completely bypassing the hospital's administrative control and billing departments?
That would change everything.
The technology to achieve that level of patient sovereignty now exists in the math we just discussed today. The power dynamic of medical data ownership is about to undergo a seismic structural shift, and the architectures we are building right now are laying the groundwork for it.
And
thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the architectures that surround you, demand better than just a locked front door, and never stop investigating the complex systems that protect your digital life.